Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Black and Queer on Campus is a new book that offers an inside look at what life is like for LGBTQ college students on campuses across the United States of America. Michael Jeffrey shows that Black and Queer college students often struggle to find safe spaces and a sense of belonging when they arrive on campus at both predominantly white institutions and historically Black colleges and universities. Many report that in predominantly white queer social spaces, they feel unwelcome and pressured to temper their criticisms of racism amongst their white peers. Conversely, in predominantly straight Black social spaces, they feel ignored or pressured to minimize their queer identity in order to be accepted. This fraught dynamic has an impact on Black LGBTQ students in higher education as they experience different forms of marginalization at the intersection of their race, gender, and sexuality. Michael Jeffries draws on interviews with students from over a dozen colleges and provides a much-needed perspective on the specific challenges that Black LGBTQ students face and the ways they overcome them. The book is Black and Queer on Campus. It is published by NYU Press. It's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Jeffries to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Jeffries is Dean of Academic Affairs, class of 1949, professor in ethics and professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. What brought this to your attention enough to want to take a deep dive into it and write the book and more importantly to talk to these students who were having these negative experiences?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think there were really two things that brought this to my attention, made me want to write the book. One was just my experience with my own students here at Wellesley. We have students from all different backgrounds and all different communities here. And I was getting the sense that some of the things that I talk about in the book with respect to queer Black students finding spaces where they really felt validated and like they fit in could be more of a widespread thing than just on campus. So that was one thing, was just my experience here on campus. And then I think the other thing was, the Black Lives Matter movement, which was really led in so many ways by queer Black women like Alicia Garza, who's one of the founders of the movement. And I was interested in hearing how students were experiencing that political moment. You know, I wrote this book during the period when the Trump administration was in power, during a period when Black Lives Matter was very much at the forefront of our national consciousness. And I wanted to know if they saw that as a movement for Black liberation or if they saw it as a movement for liberation when it came not only to race, but also to gender and sexuality and any other kind of forms of power that they were wrestling with. So those were the two main reasons.
Talk about what you feel is the reason for the homophobia that they experience that is different than the homophobia of someone of another race.
Yeah, this is a great question because I think there's a stereotype of Black homophobia as being sort of more virulent, more dangerous than other forms of homophobia, or a stereotype that Black homophobia is the reason that gay rights progress, LGBTQ rights progress has been stalled recently. And I think historically we have to understand that's a form of scapegoating. It's just not true that Black folk are the folks standing in the way of so many of these advancements. And yet we know from speaking to the students in my book and so many other places that there are particular ways in which Black homophobia plays out that are somewhat different. And one of the major ways that I found in my book is the role of religiosity in Black churches, for example. Where I have students who, are familiar with experiences in church and in many respects feel like those are kind of a home away from home. They're religious spaces of worship. But there's a double standard there or a kind of dual experience where they might know, for example, that queer folk are in the choir or in the music program at the church and those queer folk are beloved. But yet in the pulpit in the Black church, they're hearing messages about the dangers of leading a queer lifestyle or the moral wrongness of leading a queer lifestyle. So I think that that distinction, right, that disagreement, that dissonance between, on the one hand, feeling like queerness is everywhere in Black church spaces, and on the other hand, feeling as though it's denied, produces a particular set of challenges and experiences, not just in church when they're in the building, but when they go home and spend time with their family. That's the kind of messaging that they're getting about what they should be thinking when it comes to their gender expression and sexuality.
You make this point loud and clear in the book. That does not mean that black churches are more homophobic or conservative than other religious establishments in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just need to be careful. First of all, when you say black churches, right, you're really talking about, just like in any other collection of religious organizations, there's a range, right? I mean, this is not kind of one static stereotype of what a black church is. There are a range of black churches and a range of black religious experiences. And the Pew Research Center, for example, has done studies on measures of religiosity and things like opposition to gay marriage. And in some cases, some of the organizations that are most opposed to it are not black churches, right? So again, I think we need to be careful that we don't sort of scapegoat black folk and black religious organizations as the root cause of homophobia. At the same time, we have to be able to face the reality of black homophobia in our churches, in our institutions of education, in social spaces. And that's what the book tries to do. It tries to face the reality without scapegoating and stereotyping.
You talk about this, and I think it's so interesting that you talk to a lot of students, and the queer black students that you talk to made the point that they often felt that they had the primary responsibility for making spaces and educating their campuses about LGBTQ plus issues, whether that be health or politics or terminology. And their thought and what you posit in the book is that, well, it should be the faculty, it should be the school, it should be student affairs that are leading this, but it is really the students who are leading these efforts.
Yes. Yes, I appreciate your close reading here. I think this is a really important point, especially when it comes to the experiences of black students at HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. What they feel is that there's a huge vacuum in this area, that there's a lack of leadership in this area, that there's perhaps even a fear among school leadership or among the faculty that if they talk too much about the black queer presence on their campus or the reality of LGBTQ oppression or the diversity of their student body when it comes to gender expression, that it will be some sort of public relations disaster, right? That it will somehow shame the institution, that alumni will start looking at the institution in a different way, that it will make the institution less attractive to potential applicants, right? And what the students told me is, you know, because they feel like many of the employees of the college or university are afraid, they then have to step into the fray and take on the leadership role, right? And they're proud of all the work they do around education. And what they're talking about is basic education around terminology, basic education around the reality of depression and anxiety within this community, right? Basic education about the history of the LGBTQ rights struggle in this country. These are things that we should all share in the responsibility when it comes to our educational mission. But the students find themselves doing it more often than they should. So what they're looking for then, right, is just more support, more visibility, more recognition, and more investment from the professionals on campus so that they can just be students. That's why they're there, right? They're there to be students first, not to be student affairs folk, not to be faculty who are doing the education itself.
In a part of the book that you write, and this just makes your head hurt, but there are queer student organizations and they are often not welcoming to black students. And then there are black student organizations who are not welcoming to queer students. So the main question is why, and how do you overcome that and even have those organizations work together?
Great question. I think there are different reasons in each case. So when you talk about predominantly white institutions, right, and the LGBTQ student organizations on those campuses, those are multiracial organizations. But what my students told me is that in their experience, the leadership of those organizations was mostly white. And the mostly white leadership of those student organizations therefore set the agenda when it came to what were the most important issues for those organizations to tackle, what kind of social events did they set up, how did they relate to each other. And when they talked about what the agenda was, rarely, my students told me, were racial issues or the intersection of race and sexuality at the top of the list. So they were happy to kind of have the students in the room, have Black students in the room, but they didn't feel as though when they entered the room that the issues that were most important to them rose to the top of the priority list when it came to those student organizations on predominantly white campuses, right? So that's one kind of thing that's going on. And then in Black social spaces, it was sort of a similar thing where there was a kind of an expectation that when you come to a Black cultural space, you're going to focus on uplifting, sustaining Black culture. But what you're not going to do is complicate the meaning of Blackness, talk about how sexuality and gender transform your understanding of racial identity. You're not going to do those things because we have enough to worry about just when it comes to preserving Black culture and dealing with racism. So those areas were deprioritized in Black spaces as well. So either place they went, right, there was a kind of sense that, you know, I couldn't be my full self. I couldn't really talk about the intersection as much as I need to. And the groups themselves weren't prepared to tackle the complexity of my life.
Michael Jeffries is the author of the book Black and Queer on Campus. It is published by NYU. As I was reading the book, I made several notes, but one of the notes that I made in the margin was you talk about the students that you interviewed, the students that you questioned about this. They were talking about how they felt there were so few mentors. There were not many people, if any, on the faculty and the staff who share their experience, who identify with their experience as a queer Black person. My question for you is, what is the responsibility of any given educational institution to make those role models, those mentors available?
This is an excellent question. First of all, no matter what position we are recruiting for on our campuses and universities, we have a responsibility to build a deep and diverse pool of candidates for that position. And when you talk about recruiting a diverse pool of candidates, you have to really concern yourself with diversity across a range of metrics, right? Gender diversity, sexuality, racial and ethnic diversity, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the first step is you have to be committed to diversity at the level of just building a candidate pool for the jobs you have to fill, right? And then as you go through the process, as you go through the hiring process, you have to weigh, right, how is it that people who contribute different experiences to my campus can be valued through the hiring process, right? So that's one thing is at the level of recruitment, you've got to kind of prioritize that. And then I think there are some other structural things that we can do. So for example, if you're a college or university, and you have a gender and sexuality studies program that's quite strong, right? And you invested in it, and you know you're going to be hiring in that area, right? That's a better place to be because you're giving yourself more chances to represent diversity within that area of your curriculum than if you're a university or college that has a really small gender and sexuality studies program and doesn't really invest in it and doesn't want to keep up with the cutting edge research in that area. Similarly, in student affairs, right, if you have an intercultural education division and there are cultural advisors for various groups, but you don't have a kind of strong cultural advising program for LGBTQ+ folk, that's another area where if you invest in that area of your student affairs work, you're more likely to build a set of diverse candidates to fill those positions. So it's about A, the positions you create, and B, how do we go through the recruitment process when it comes to building a diverse pool of candidates?
So this is something you live with every day, right? I mean, you're the Dean of Academic Affairs at Wellesley. You are Black, you are straight, you are cisgender, and you have to see what you can do to create a welcoming environment for queer students who are coming to your campus.
Absolutely. And it is something that we do every day, and it has to be a part of your job. So I think one of the other kind of misconceptions about this work is that it sort of only belongs in the realm of the person designated to work on diversity and inclusion at a college or university. And the reality is, right, it's everyone's job, right? It's everyone's job, whether you're in a faculty position, whether you're in an administrative position, whether you're in student affairs, no matter what it is, right, we all have to take responsibility for doing this kind of work. And that's what we do on a daily basis. We try to keep these issues at the front of mind. And I think the other piece of this story is we have to be willing to listen to our students. Even if we work in administration and we have a better view of of what the college business is, if we get to a place where we're shutting our students out of that conversation, we're not serving anybody well. So that's the other thing, is we have to at least be willing to listen when they tell us about the needs they have. It doesn't mean that we can do every single thing that they ask, but we have to be able to keep those lines of communication open.
In the students you talked to, what did you hear about what went into their decision of what college and what type of college they were going to attend?
You know, it's interesting because many of the students in the book describe the same set of factors that all students consider when they're applying to college. Geography, how close is the place to the place where you currently live? What is the cost of attendance? Can I afford it? What's the prestige of the institution? Those are kind of the main factors that people discuss. But there were other things that they noticed when they went to visit college campuses. And especially for the students who chose HBCUs, you know, they reported feeling a sense of home when they visited those campuses for the first time. They reported really valuing the Black diversity that they saw on campus. I mean, this is the reality, right? There's no one way to be Black. And when you go to an HBCU campus, you see the beauty and the breadth of Black diversity right in front of you from the moment you step on that place. And that, I think, was a signal to many of the students who chose to attend HBCUs that I can be myself here because I see the range of people who call this place home.
The other thing, and we'll probably end on this, but it's so complex because even if there are Black queer students that then, and we touched on this earlier, but then enter a space for white queer students, you would think that there would be a bonding and an understanding in those issues. But Black queer students find that very challenging for many reasons. And one of them is often white racism, which is prevalent throughout regarding your sexuality.
Oh, regardless, no question.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, no question. Look, the LGBTQ student groups that the students stepped into really did provide a chance for some of that bonding. And it wasn't a universally negative experience for the students that I spoke with. But having said that, right, racism cuts across all lines of identity, right, all kinds of identity groups. And especially when it comes to stereotypes of Black sexuality, right, Black sexuality is somehow dangerous. Black sexuality is somehow deviant or criminal, right? Those stereotypes are very much in play, whether we're talking about traditionally straight and cisgender spaces or genderqueer and sexuality queer spaces. So look, just joining a group that is liberal in one sense, right, that kind of liberalism when it comes to sexuality and gender identity does not inoculate anyone from the reality of racism, right? If you're here, right, if you're living in America today and through the country's history, you're going to have to deal with racism as a daily reality. And the students certainly do struggle with that from time to time.
With 90 seconds on the clock remaining, where does your hope lie? And where is the hope that these students see?
Yeah. So let's start with the students first. I think that there are some students, and first of all, not all the students are that hopeful. I mean, I have to say, you know, in speaking with these students in the historical moment that I did, many of them were very discouraged with the direction of the country. So that's just a reality. But then there were others who really, because of their experiences as queer Black folk, were able to imagine things so far beyond where we are now. I mean, just imagining, you know, different conceptions of gender, imagining different racial futures, imagining new versions of democracy and governmental practice, imagining a new relationship to the criminal justice system, to systems of wealth and capitalism. So many students really do imagine really different futures, and we have to invest in that kind of courageous imagination when it comes to our students, because they are the future and our future is tied to theirs. And then I think my hope, right, in writing the book is really a little bit more modest, in that I think if there's one thing that folk can take away from this book, it's that there's no one way to belong to the LGBTQ community, and there's no one way to be Black, and there's no one way to be Black and queer. What the students gave me in this book was a rainbow, truly, of their experiences. And I think that displaying that rainbow, illustrating that diversity, has to be empowering for all of us, those of us who maybe know the topic a little bit better, and certainly those of us who are just dipping our toe in the water for the first time.
Such a great point. The name of the book is Black and Queer on Campus. It is published by NYU. Michael Jeffries, an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for speaking to these important issues this morning.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Again, Michael Jeffries is the author of Black and Queer on Campus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.